there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. Just be fair. Be decent. The golden rule. Do to others what you want done to yourself. Be reasonable. If you're fair, you're decent, you're reasonable, there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. I've been involved in this thing now for 30 years, and it's a very sobering thought that my whole life has spending years and years and years focused on this tiny pinprick on the world's map. When I read Chris Hedges' books, he has this global range, this depth and sweep. He'll quote to you the classical writers, he'll quote to you little tidbit facts, we learn little tidbit facts from him here and there, and all I have is Israel, Palestine, give me my support, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And now I'm hopeful. I think there's a real opportunity. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be at that rendezvous of victory. And I hope to see all of you there with me.
Straightforward. What do you think, what is the difference between terrorism and the freedom fighters?
Second person, please.
Hello. I just wanted to know what was your outtake on the Ahmadinejad visit to Lebanon, and if you think Turkey, Syria, and Iran will have a big part to play if and when a war will break out between Hezbollah and Israel.
If Israel knows what Hezbollah is capable of doing and what Hassan Nasrallah is capable of doing, why they would try, if they are looking for victory, why they would invade them knowing that they will have some kind of resistance?
Thank you.
On the first question, technical difference between a freedom fighter and a terrorist would be a person who targets civilians in order to achieve a political goal is a terrorist by definition. And a freedom fighter can also be a terrorist. He or she can be interested in freeing his or her people, but still engages in terrorism. So it's not as if one precludes the other. The only other thing I would say on it is that the laws of war, as they're called, I don't feel comfortable with that concept of laws of war. But the laws of war, as currently constructed, they put it, the guerrilla, the non-state movements at a very big disadvantage, because they say that you can only use a weapon if the weapon is precise enough that it will target civilian sites. But what does precise enough mean? It basically means, what is the latest technology? If the latest technology is very precise, then weapons which are less than very precise, they then become banned under international law. And so in effect, it's only states which can produce very precision technology that get to use weapons. What that means in practice is, take the case of Hamas. Hamas is immediately condemned for war crimes, even if none of its weapons hit a civilian target because the weapon itself is considered imprecise, and so they're not allowed to use it. And so in effect, it means for non-state actors, they are disarmed from the get-go under the current laws of war. On the second question about Ahmadinejad, Syria, and Turkey, that was one aspect I have to omit from my prepared remarks, which is that's all the more reason, which brings us to the third question, all the more reason that Israel is inclined to attack, because from the Israeli point of view, a coalition has now grown, has coalesced, and these Arabs, these Muslims, are just getting too uppity. They're acting like Nasser in 1967. So you have Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and then suddenly out of thin air, now you have this character, Mr. Erdogan. And Mr. Erdogan has this strange notion that Turkey is important and that Turkey should have a say. And so these Arabs, they're forming this coalition and they need to be cut down to size, which is exactly what Israel did in 1967 when it dealt a shattering blow to what was then called radical Arab nationalism. And they want to deal that same shattering blow. In 67 it was Egypt, Syria, and then the Lebanon, Jordan. Now, as I said, it's Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, and tentatively Turkey. And so there's this need to cut them down to size. Now, the question is, why are they focusing on Hezbollah? Well, Iran is not an option because the United States will not give a green light for an attack on Iran. You might then say, what about Syria? It is quite clear, all the reports that have come out have said that Israel will immediately, if it attacks Lebanon, it will also attack Syria. And you know it's coming because all you have to read is your daily paper and you'll see every once in a while there's a news story about how Syrian factories are supplying weapons for Hezbollah, and that Israel is going to attack Syria if there is a war with Lebanon. As to your implied question, well, doesn't Israel know it will be defeated if it goes to war against Hezbollah? A, it's not clear for certain, we don't know, whether Israel would be defeated. And B, Israelis are very much of the opinion that they have learned the lessons. They keep saying we've learned from the errors of 2006, and this time we can do it right. And then there's the other thing, which is Israel, in its mind, it has no choice because the Arabs are getting out of hand. And in the Israeli mentality, Arabs only understand the language of force, which is, as Freud would say, a projection. And so I learned about projection from one of Chris Hedges' books. they have to cut them down.
We'll take four if you don't mind. Please go ahead.
Thank you. As the current, we'll call it the peace process, has been circling and drained for the last few weeks, we've been reading a lot more pro and con about the advisability or otherwise of Palestine making moves to garner widespread support for statehood. I wonder if you could give us your view on that.
Thank you. Please.
With the deterioration of the situation over the last 40 years and even continuing after the peace process began, and the facts on the ground now, is what's your opinion on the feasibility of a two-state solution anymore? And is it time to start thinking about a one-state solution as a rational option?